loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Donald Trump will get his military parade, although it won't include tanks because they could wreck Washington, D.C.'s roads. Still, experts say the cost of the parade could feed every homeless veteran in America. Next, Immigration and Customs Enforcement has detained a prominent immigrant and reproductive rights activist, Alejandra Pablos. She's not undocumented, but is a legal permanent resident. She had a DUI arrest nearly a decade ago, and advocates say her detention is a result of her activism, and especially for a recent protest she led against the Department of Homeland Security. Then China's legislature approved the proposal to remove term limits on the country's presidency yesterday, setting the stage of President Xi Jinping to continue in office after his current five-year term ends in 2023. And then Colombia voted in legislative elections Sunday as the country's peace process struggles to stay alive amid a wave of paramilitary violence. Yesterday's election comes ahead of the presidential polls in May and June. And finally, we have an analysis of the Pennsylvania special election coming up this week. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. And now we turn to Donald Trump's military parade. Donald Trump will get his military parade, although it won't include tanks because they would wreck Washington, D.C.'s roads. Still, experts say that the cost of the parade could feed every homeless veteran in America. We're joined by Ajah Mubaraka. He's a longtime human rights activist, organizer, and political activist, and he was the 2016 Green Party nominee for Vice President of the United States. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Ajamu, public opinion polls say this parade is a stupid idea. Military leaders are saying it's a stupid idea. Donald Trump is pushing it forward. And now we're seeing in the news that it's going to feature a period military uniforms to remind us of our greatness through history. What in the world is Donald Trump doing? Why is he pushing this thing?
Well, you know, two things. I think that it's quite clear that leaders in Washington, D.C. Hardly ever respond to popular opinion. So there's no doubt that he's going to continue to push his ideal for this parade. But secondly, this is really an obscene attempt to continue the process of normalizing militarism in this culture. And that's why it's so important for it to be opposed. This notion that the U.S. is going to flex its muscle by displaying its long history of military aggression and I would assume displaying various kinds of weapons right in the middle of a national conversation around the issue of guns and violence. So it becomes really a slap in the face. To all of those who are concerned about the normalization of militarism and violence in this culture. So it's really something that, again, needs to be opposed because the objective, the ideological objective, in my opinion, is to continue the process of normalizing and accepting, of course, violence.
That's the voice of Ajah Mubaraka. Ajah was the vice presidential candidate in the 2016 presidential election, along with Dr. Jill Stein for the Green Party ticket. He's also a central organizer with Black Alliance for Peace. Ajamu, I know as a member of the Answer Coalition that a lot of groups, your organization, veterans organizations, peace organizations, labor groups, housing organizations, a lot of people are coming together to organize a massive presence on Veterans Day weekend when this glorification of war takes place, this obscene, as you put it, waste of money as well. Talk about, again, because this is so impactful, Trump wants to have a military parade. But if we go back to the legacy of Dr. King, starting in late 1966, and then, of course, in the April 4th, 1967 Riverside church speech where he comes out against the Vietnam War, King is making the connection between imperial wars abroad and the failure to fight poverty in the United States. He's making a lot of those connections. Talk about what this new anti-war coalition that's come together around the Veterans Day military parade, what you're thinking, what you're signaling, what your demands will be.
Well, I think that it's really important that this coalition is, in fact, coming together around the opposition to this parade. And I really want to praise ANSWR for its leadership in this process. It is vitally important that we take this opportunity and the general trend that we see in this culture over the last 10 years or so to demonstrate that there is, in fact, a still viable anti-war, anti-imperialist, pro-peace movement here in this country. So in some ways, the Trump administration's pushing for this military parade is providing us a real organizing opportunity, in my opinion. We want to demonstrate that that substantial sectors of the American people are not going to allow themselves to be manipulated into this grotesque reflection of American dominance, and that they believe that peace is a possibility and that we don't have to engage in war. And we don't need to continue to waste the enormous resources that are being transferred from the public straight into the pockets of the military industrial complex. As you said in your intro, that you know, the cost of this parade itself could feed all of the homeless vets here in this country. So this continued squandering of the public's resources to advance militarism and to protect the interests of the 1%. This is the kind of opportunity we need to really engage in the national conversation we need to engage in to demonstrate that the interests of the Trump administration and the bipartisan neoliberal crowd there in D.C. are completely opposed to the interests of most of us here in this country.
You know, the numbers, the comment about feeding homeless veterans comes from the administration. Mick Mulvaney, the director of the Office of Management and Budget, said that, and this is, again, using the administration's very conservative figures, that the money that is being spent on this parade could feed every homeless veteran in America three meals a day for 15 days. There's no excuse for a country like this.
But it demonstrates that they care nothing about the lives of these real live human beings. Because if they did, then they would also be concerned about the fact that we still have this obscene number of veterans who are committing suicide every day. If people really cared about the vets, then they would oppose all of these examples of militarism, because we know that when these young men and now women are set off to die for the 1%, when they realize once they are deployed that they're basically being used and they are put in situations where they end up committing war crimes and crimes against humanity, it becomes more than many of them can bear. And we see the consequence of that with these continued suicides. So if you care about the troops, if you care about basic morality, then you oppose all of these examples of militarism in this culture. If you care about the question of guns and armaments, then you have to question the connection between your concerns and this normalization of militarism with this parade.
Brian, for all the press that Donald Trump has gotten over this parade, the parade's not exactly a done deal, is it?
Well, they're going forward now. And it also shows and demonstrates the colonial character of Washington, D.C. I mean, Washington is historically a majority black city. Through racist gentrification, it's no longer majority black, although a very, very substantial African-American population. It has a D.C. council, the, quote, city council, the council, which they don't call it the city council because it should be a state and it should be something like a state legislature. But this council, even the officials, don't want this parade. The first day of the announcement came out, the council announced tanks, but no tanks, meaning we don't want this. And yet the people in Washington, D.C., including their elected representatives, actually have no say. It's not up to the people of D.C. And we don't have there's no elected member of Congress from D.C. This is shoved down the throats of the people in the district who don't like Trump, who don't favor this military parade. It's an obscenity in so many ways. You know, the U.S. military budget is 10 times larger than Russia's military budget. The military budget of the DPRK, North Korea, is the size of the New York City Police Department. The U.S. spends more than 10 times, it spends more than the next 10 countries combined. And now to have a parade coming down Washington's Main Street, Pennsylvania Avenue, signals a cynical use of the military and veterans and soldiers as a prop. It's a political prop. And John was right. Veterans are always a prop. They have the right to go and be saluted by opportunist politicians who themselves don't go to war, but they don't have a right to a house. They don't have a right to a job. They don't have a right to really a decent mental health care if they come back from these endless wars of invasion and occupation. This is a fraud, and we should call it, we should call it for what it is. Ajamu, how can people actually get involved? I know in the Answer Coalition, we're organizing, but there is this coalition. I want to ask you to talk a little bit more about it and how people can get involved. I think hundreds of thousands of people might be coming to Washington, D.C. On Veterans Day to oppose Donald Trump in the military parade. 1 minute left.
You're absolutely right. And we want people to, in fact, mobilize and come out. For this demonstration of popular opposition to this obscenity. And there are a number of places they can go. And Brian, you may need to help me with this. I know that they can go to the No U.S. Foreign Bases website to get more information. They can go to the website of the United National Anti-War Coalition. Of course, they can go to the Answer website to get more information. The call is being made, and of course, I can go to the Black Alliance for Peace to get information on this. The call is being made for a massive mobilization of the people to come to D.C. and to demonstrate again that there is a conscious element in this country that are actively opposed to the waste of resources and the continued representation of the U.S. as an immoral society. And so we want to show people that there are significant numbers of people in this country who stand with the oppressed of the world and don't support this grotesque representation and expression of U.S. military aggression.
That is it right there. We're joined by Ajamu Baraka. He is a longtime human rights activist, organizer, and political activist, and he was the 2016 Green Party nominee for Vice President of the United States. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement has detained a prominent immigrant and reproductive rights activist, Alejandra Pablos. She is not undocumented, but is a legal permanent resident. She had a DUI arrest nearly a decade ago, and advocates say her detention is a result of her activism, especially for a recent protest she led against the Department of Homeland Security. We're joined from Virginia by Margie Del Castillo, who serves as the Director of Field and Advocacy for the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. Margie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Margie, even the Washington Post reported on this. This has been a story all over the country. Alejandra is has been in this country for many years. She's a legal permanent resident. She carries a green card. She did her normal check-in, which she always did on time, and ICE grabbed her. So tell us what's happening with her case right now.
Yeah, it's a lot. So thank you so much to you all for highlighting this really important story and what's going on. So Alejandra has been an immigrant rights and a reproductive justice organizer for a long time. She's very well known nationally as well as in Arizona and most recently in Virginia, where she's focused a lot of her organizing work on and where I work with her directly. So currently on March 7th, we know that Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, took Alejandra into detainment in Arizona, where she went to check in, as she's done over the last several years, peacefully and successfully every time. And this time they detained her. And when they brought her they had talked to her about offering her a bond hearing, and they ended up not doing that. So they reneged on a promise that they had made to her, that they had said would happen when she went to check in this time. And so she's currently being detained there now, most likely at the Eloy Detention Center. Actually, she is at the Eloy Detention Center now, officially. And we are working as much as we can to get her that bond hearing so that we can get her out.
Yeah, the DUI arrest is being called a crime of moral turpitude by ICE. Now, moral turpitude can have any definition that ICE wants it to have. You can scoop anybody up for any reason and say that they're victim of doing something that that qualifies as moral turpitude. And Margie made another important point, Brian. That is that she was not allowed a bond hearing, and the reason she was not allowed a bond hearing is because just a month ago, the Supreme Court ruled that people being held for deportation are not entitled to a bond hearing. Now, she doesn't have any kind of other hearing scheduled until next December of 2018. And she is going to be in this prison awaiting deportation or a hearing on her deportation for the rest of the year.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that, well, that there's many pieces to this. She should be released. I mean, people
without
all over
question.
The country are demanding her freedom. This is vindictive. It's punitive.
It's solely political.
And it's political. It's, in other words, she's exercising First Amendment rights, free speech rights. She's saying, you know, stop the barbaric harassment, intimidation, roundup, mass arrest, and deportation of immigrants. Stop breaking up immigrant families. And for that crime, that's her real.
Yeah, that's the crime.
I'm using air quotes, crime. She's been singled out. So anyway, she should be released. But you're right, John, and I want Margie, if you would, to speak about this. The recent Supreme Court ruling opens the door, and I think most Americans don't know this, to indefinite detention, which I would say would be the negation or the opposite of actual democracy.
Yeah, I mean, I think also what we can see is really just a clear case of retaliation, right? I think that's what we're really trying to uplift here. Alejandra has checked in with ICE peacefully and successfully for several years. And it's no coincidence that in January, at a protest, a peaceful protest in Richmond, Virginia, at a DHS building, she was targeted and picked out of the crowd and arrested. And we know that from the way that the Chesterfield County officials work in Virginia, they often do this to try to silence folks, but they often also drop the charges because they don't want to deal with the ramifications of actually charging folks for exercising their First Amendment rights. And what they didn't know when they chose Alejandra was that she had this ongoing case and that the grave impact that this would have on her case. And so we can see that, you know, not even a month later, right, she had to go check in with ICE, and it clearly had an impact in terms of the actions that she had taken in January protesting peacefully. So we can see that it's just a clear act of retaliation.
And this case is garnering a lot of attention, even in Hollywood. I note in one article that the actress Alyssa Milano wrote to her 3.4 million Twitter followers on Wednesday, quote, "Another immigrant rights activist detained by ICE after protesting deportations. Please sign here for support." And that the petition calling for Alejandra to be released already has 8,000 signatures. It just started to be circulated.
It now even has more than that, I think. Sorry to interrupt you. I think it has close to 20,000.
Mm-hmm. 20,000 signatures. I hope that that has some sort of impact. Are there any political figures who have weighed in on this case? Are you getting any kind of support? Or I should ask, is she getting any kind of support from any of our elected officials?
Yeah, that's actually a strategy that we're working on right now. There have been many members of Congress that have reached out privately to different people to express their support and wanting to know what they can do. And right now, what we're asking people to do is to offer letters of support. So that's currently our ask to members of Congress and local elected officials, is to write out, you know, officially on their letterhead why they support Alejandra and why this is something that shouldn't be happening to people who are just exercising their First Amendment rights. So we are in the process of collecting public statements from those people that we can then share out to show that the community supports Alejandra, not just community members, but elected officials, celebrities. Everyone knows that this is wrong, what's happening to her. And every day that goes by that she's detained is an injustice against her.
That's the voice of Margie Del Castillo. She's an associate director of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. We're talking about a terrible injustice and the efforts by thousands, and I believe this could become hundreds of thousands or even millions of people, the way things work now, coming into the political process to demand her freedom. Margie, I'm looking at the Washington Post, which also, as John mentioned, there's been a lot of media coverage. Washington Post quotes you, and you say, she is our primary organizer. She's been very instrumental in leadership development for other activists. Talk about what the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health does and what her role was or is.
We are an organization. We're the only national reproductive justice organization that works with Latinas and their families across the country. And we deeply organize in four states, in Virginia, Texas, Florida, and New York. And so Alejandra has been the primary Virginia organizer for about almost close to 2 years. And I've been her direct supervisor during that time. And Alejandra, when I hired her, you know, I typically don't hire folks that aren't from a state, right? That don't have like the background or the community, but I believed in Alejandra so much because of her strong organizing background that she brought from Arizona and the amazing work that's happened on the ground there. And I wanted to see that grow here in Virginia. And so that's why I hired her, and she proved me right again and again. The community that she's built here is so impressive. She's developed Latinx activists through our leadership development trainings. In particular, we hold trainings that are called Latinas Organizing for Leadership and Advocacy. And that's where we train folks on how to advocate for themselves, how to advocate for their communities. We get folks media trained so that they can speak to the media and, you know, media can hear from people who are directly impacted by the issues that we're facing. And so Alejandra did a lot of that work. She trained leaders. She particularly worked in the state legislative session, mobilizing community members to come to Richmond, Virginia, to show the legislators there that we exist, that they are Latinx members in their community that do care about the issues. Because, you know, oftentimes we know that in these elected official spaces in particular, there are not people that believe in us, right, or that look like us or that represent us. So the work that she was doing to mobilize impacted community members to those spaces that have long time been exclusionary was, it's just, you can't even name the value of that. And so without her here, we're feeling the impact already. She's been gone for almost a week now, detained in that awful setting in Eloy, and her activists miss her. Our base here missed her very much, and they ask me about her every day, and they're also working really hard to free her and to gather petition signatures. And her impact has just been incredibly large scale across the state.
Margie, is she able to communicate with anybody? I noticed that she had a Facebook post that was posted after her arrest. Was that her or was that somebody doing it on her behalf?
It was someone doing it on her behalf. She doesn't have control of her social media channels right now, but there was a coordination because she was afraid that something like this could happen where she has right and trusted individuals that could run, you know, different messaging and different things on her channels. But there are some people, especially from the organization Mi Gente, who are working really closely with her legal case, who have been able to speak with her. I know that someone from there spoke with her over the weekend, and she is okay. I mean, obviously she's shaken and afraid and does not want to be there, but is fighting from the inside and certainly asks everyone to keep the fight for her outside so that we can get her out.
Whether she is released or, God forbid, deported, this is going to be her legacy. Her legacy is going to be one of increased activism. People are going to take strength from the way she stood up to ICE, and she's inspiring other people. This is a movement that I believe is going to continue to grow in response to the heavy-handedness that we're seeing from ICE and from this administration. Margie, we have about 45 seconds left. Tell us what people can do to show their support for Alejandra, or what they can do to show their support for the issue here, opposing ICE and these roundups and deportations.
Well, immediately for Alejandra, we're asking folks to go to bit.ly/releaseale. And there you can go to a landing page for our campaign where you can read a little bit more background on her case and also sign the petition and a letter of support that will go straight to the judge that we're asking for a bond hearing for. We want to show up to that, you know, judge with 500, 1,000 letters of support that show all the organizations and people that are behind her. So that's something immediately that people can do now. And I think long term, people can start talking more about ICE in their communities. You know, ICE has not been around for that long, right? people view it as an establishment that has to be here, that's an institution. And it has only been around for like 13 years or so, and it hasn't been around that long. It doesn't have to stay here. That was a mistake that was made in creating it in a time of xenophobic and racist climate that we were living in, and like much like we are now. And we can fight back against it. So people can start questioning that institution in their communities and talking to their elected officials about the importance of abolishing it.
That was the voice of Margie Del Castillo. She joined us from Virginia, and she serves as the Director of Field and Advocacy for the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We will be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
China's legislature approved the proposal to remove term limits on the country's presidency yesterday, setting the stage for President Xi Jinping to continue in office after his current five-year term ends in 2023. We're joined from San Francisco by David Ewing. He is the chair of the San Francisco chapter of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association. Welcome back, David.
Great to be back. Thank you.
I noticed, David, that in Europe, there was, according to the New York Times, great alarm over the fact that China has abolished a two-term limit for the presidency. I found that funny in a way because Angela Merkel, who's really the leader of Germany, just started her fourth term in office. But outside of the double standard, is there significance to this move on the part of China? Why did they do it?
No, I think they did it because the president's performance in the past two terms has been pretty important, pretty effective. And China is entering a period of a very complex period coming ahead. And I think the party felt the need for stability through the upcoming changes, which are very significant, in my opinion.
Okay, let's sort of unpack that. What are the big issues? Why is it more complicated? I mean, it's always complicated, isn't it? I mean, let's just help the audience understand what it is that the Chinese are contending with. It would seem that if all is well, they could retain the two-term limit because whoever took Xi Jinping's place, you know, would continue a policy if it was, in fact, a policy that was working. I'm wondering if there is a factional division within the Chinese Communist Party. Of course, that's true for almost all political parties. Might it be true in the case of China as well?
Of course, it might be true. And there have been differences in the party, you know, because there was pretty significant anti-corruption campaign that reached very high levels within the Chinese Communist Party. So, yes, I know there are differences within the party. We can tell from the kind of things that have happened, the people who have been convicted of different dishonest activities. So there's that. But I really think that the big things, the key is really if you look at the 19th Congress documents. The party is committed to a full socialist, building a full-scale socialist society. And that we knew beginning in 1978, when the party adopted this plan to use a market economy to develop a socialist base for later communism. We knew there are risks involved and using market forces and capitalist forces, really. And there are capitalists, as you know, who run businesses in China. They don't control the economy. The party controls the economy. But there are capitalists, and they control things like retail sector, you know, where there are some big internet companies like Alibaba. So these are powerful actors. And China is determined. China's going to build a communist society. That means they're all going to lose. And it's going to take place over a relatively long period of time. And the 19th Party Congress kind of focuses on this problem, how to build a complete socialist society. And they kind of do it within about the next 30 years. So they expect to have a developed socialist economy based on equality of income in about within the next 30 years. It's a pretty big accomplishment. And a pretty treacherous thing to handle, because capitalists have money; they can affect the party, corrupt it. They have power, so it's something that the party has to handle very delicately, And Xi Jinping has been very committed to building socialism. He's really pulled the party towards the left. And I think it's, you see his influence in the 19th Party Congress that wants to move towards really developed socialism.
That's David Ewing. David, I agree with you. I want to try to help the broader lay audience here understand possibly what some of that language might mean. That the Chinese Communist Party took power in October 1949. They used traditional socialist methods. Public property, private property was not in command, at least certainly in the central parts of the economy. They organized the economy according to economic planning. At a certain point after the death of Mao Zedong in the mid-1970s, the new leadership change decided to reintroduce capitalism or a market economy and also to invite foreign corporations to carry out direct foreign investment in China. And as a consequence, a capitalist class did develop in China at the toleration of the ruling Communist Party. And Western corporations came in and were able to make a lot of profit, but the quid pro quo from the Chinese point of view was to develop or to ascertain technology that was pretty much the monopoly of Western powers, and that technology has been assimilated by China. And what you're suggesting now is that here we are 40 years after 1978, the Chinese Communist Party is turning back to its original perspective of socialism. In other words, they use capitalism and the introduction of foreign direct investment from Western capitalist corporations to develop their economy because they felt they were at too low of a level to go forward to a socialist economy. The means of production, the technological apparatus was not developed enough to carry it out, but perhaps now it is, but then they will have to resist some of the same forces that they conjured up into existence to pursue this path for the past 40 years. Is that, in essence, what you're saying?
Beginning in the 1970s, China began using its comparative advantage. Its economic comparative advantage was in low wages. But China had a very talented, well-trained, well-educated workforce that had developed from 1949 to 1978. But they used that comparative advantage to bring foreign capital into the country and to allow some capitalist enterprises within the states. So that was an important factor and was the main mechanism they used to get where they are today. But China now is determined to move towards socialism, so that they have to reorient the economy. And I think Xi Jinping's leadership has been important, moving the party to the left, which is a sort of a real change in direction, away from private enterprise and towards the socialization of all areas of life within China. China now has expanded healthcare, education, a lot of public transportation is free. So they're moving in that direction pretty quickly.
David, what does all this mean for the United States? Does this have any impact on the U.S. or on its foreign policy?
I think the U.S. remains cautious, hostile to China because it's China's success seems like a zero-sum game to the rulers, I think, in the United States. If China is stronger, then it's stronger than us. So I think there's always that danger. And because just as we can see the success of China and its growth patterns, enemies of China, the ruling class in the U.S., they can see it too. So you see, I think the U.S. Navy has been more aggressive in the last month or two in the Pacific. And I think we can expect there's a danger of confrontation if against China. But at the same time, China is stronger. Its military is nothing like the U.S. military, but it might be strong enough to defend itself.
So, David Ewing, I think you're right there, and we could see with the national strategy doctrine that was just announced, as well as the national nuclear posture review, that the United States is in fact preparing for a major power confrontation, and the two countries identified are Russia and China. And of course, if the United States views China as a principal competitor, a strategic competitor, And that may help explain the so-called Asia pivot, whereby the United States will, by 2020, have 60% of all U.S. naval and Air Force assets in the Pacific region. It seems like we may be, in fact, heading in that direction, even though it seems like madness at the same time. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We've been joined from San Francisco by David Ewing. He is the co-chair of the San Francisco chapter of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Colombia voted in legislative elections on Sunday as the country's peace process struggles to stay alive amid a wave of paramilitary violence. Yesterday's election comes ahead of the presidential polls in May and June. We're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. He's a human rights and labor lawyer who is the author of the soon-to-be-released book, The Plot to Attack Iran. Dan will be helping to lead a delegation to Colombia ahead of the presidential election. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you very much.
Dan, what can you tell us about the status of this ongoing election, especially in light of this paramilitary violence and the recent upheaval among former members of the FARC?
Yes, well, I think the context is that the peace agreement is very close to being dead, if it isn't already, for the reasons you say, that the violence on the part of the right-wing paramilitaries in Colombia has only increased since the peace agreement was entered into. And I think there's going to be a cloud over the elections because of this violence. And I will say most certainly there's no doubt that it'll turn out the paramilitaries were pressuring people to vote certain ways in the legislative elections that just happened this weekend, with the result being that the right wing won big in the legislative elections and the left wing, which on the presidential levels, polling almost even with the right wing, got very few votes. So I have to believe that the violence actually had a huge impact on the legislative elections and will also have on the presidential elections. You may or may not know that the left wing candidate, Gustavo Petro, was actually just survived an assassination attempt a couple weeks ago. So it's very serious.
Conservatives are winning, it appears, a plurality in this parliamentary election. They don't have a majority. Who would they have to go into a coalition with? And could it be centrist parties or left of center parties that might moderate their conservative politics?
It would probably be centrist to right parties, not left-wing parties. And again, I think when in Colombia, when you talk about, you know, the spectrum of left to right, it's much greater than it is in this country. That is, the left, you know, the left is communist, and then the right is could be characterized as fascist. So the fact that, you know, an ultra right would combine with a so-called kind of centrist group, I think probably guarantees that it's going to be a pretty far to the right government, at least from our vantage point.
How does this impact on the FARC or the former FARC organization, generally speaking? I mean, they started the armed struggle in 1964, a long time ago, 55 years almost. They started that armed struggle because there was actually a reign of terror against peasant activists and people in the countryside who were advocating land reform. The U.S. government over these many decades supported the Colombian government and de facto many of this right-wing militias that were carrying out their reign of terror. So after many starts and false starts, finally negotiations under the sort of guarantee of Cuba, the negotiations happened in Havana between the Colombian government and the FARC. This peace process went forward. Then it almost didn't go forward when it failed at a referendum, which took a lot of people by surprise. But nonetheless, the FARC has lived up to its side of the deal. It's demobilized. It's disarmed. Now we have FARC people being assassinated by right-wing militias. We have many, many assassinations among social activists who are not necessarily with the FARC at all, but who are progressive. And as a consequence of what you're laying out, the intimidation, the right-wing paramilitary intimidation at the polls, costing even more votes for the left, many more right-wing votes than would have been thought given the recent polling. How does this play back within FARC itself? Will it be evaluated that the FARC has made a big mistake by disarming?
I think it will be viewed as a mistake. I think it has been for some time by many people. I think, though, the FARC went in with its eyes open, that is to say that they knew this was a risk, that this very thing could happen, that they could agree to a peace deal that they would honor and that the government would not. Just a little historical background. In the 80s, the FARC agreed to a peace deal in which it laid down its arms in return for engaging the political process. It formed a party called the Patriotic Union Party, the UP, and 3,000 to 5,000 UP candidates and members were killed, and the FARC went back into the mountains. They knew that could happen again, and in fact, it is happening again. They made a calculated, took a calculated risk, I believe, because they were not as strong as they had been. They had been weakened by a number of key assassinations of leaders. And in any case, and actually Castro himself thought that the day of the armed struggle was over. So for various reasons, you know, the FARC decided at least to try this. But again, I think they're seeing they now have no leverage. You know, with their arms given up, what is their leverage to get the government to abide by the deal? The answer is none. And so I think it probably was a mistake to agree to a deal in which they disarmed so quickly and had no, again, left themselves with absolutely no leverage to force the government to honor it.
So then what happens to the FARC, Dan? It's not just going to go away. It's not going to just say, well, we tried, we lost, we give up and walk away. What next?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I think, well, already there are some small rogue groups from the FARC that continue to exist armed. Others may join those ranks, I would think. I would think others in the FARC will at least continue to try to engage in the political process despite the risks to their own lives in doing so. I guess I'd be surprised, though, if we saw a FARC on the scale that we had in previous decades. I don't see a major rebuilding of the FARC at this point. And so in that sense, I think the government probably played this well from their point of view and drew out the negotiations long enough, you know, so that the FARC continued to be weak and weak and weak. And by the time they signed the deal and again, kind of left the FARC in a place where they had to sign something. And again, they're left with very little leverage. So I don't see a big guerrilla movement building again in that country.
Dan Kovalik is our guest. We're talking about Colombia's parliamentary elections that took place yesterday. The right did much better than was expected. These are the run-up to the national elections. There's another armed guerrilla group. It was much smaller than the FARC, but not minuscule by any stretch of the imagination, and that's the ELN. They have not, as of yet, as far as I understand, come to an agreement with the government to disband. What's the status with the government ELN negotiations under these circumstances? And is it possible that some of the FARC people who feel there's no hope here through the political process, the only thing they're looking at is the abyss, perhaps? And I don't mean to be overly gloomy. Maybe that's not the case. But might some of those same fighters, organizers, advocates, activists or cadres go in the direction of the ELN? Will the ELN's armed struggle continue?
I think the ELN struggle will probably continue. Right now, the negotiations have broken down between the ELN and the government because of some attacks that the ELN has made. And so I think the prospects for an agreement with the ELN in the near future are pretty dim. And yeah, I certainly could see, you know, some folks from the FARC joining them. In fact, there was, at least in some areas, a FARC-ELN, you know, agreement or a unity agreement in place before all this. So I think that's very possible. Again, I don't think you'll ever see guerrillas totally gone from the Colombian landscape, but I don't see them as the force that they had been in the past.
Dan Kovalik, you're going to Colombia to be part of an international observer group to observe the elections. How does that work? Where will you go? And also, how is the security for the International Election Observer Group guaranteed, if it is?
Yeah, there's no security guaranteed. You know, you go to Colombia for the most part, you know, hoping for the best. We will go to fly into Cali and go into towns within driving distance of that city, for example, to Buenaventura, which has some of the worst human rights in Colombia, and hope that our just mere presence in those areas might deter some violence. And there's some experience that suggests that it might. So that's really the main goal.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. He's a human rights and labor lawyer. He's the author of several books, including one soon-to-be-released book called The Plot to Attack Iran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
We're going to continue our talk with Jacqueline Lukman, the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation. She's looking at races around the country that are going to be very important for the upcoming midterm elections. Jacqueline, welcome back.
Thank you.
So let's talk about Pennsylvania. Let's first talk about this special election that's happening on Tuesday in Pennsylvania's 18th district. You've got the weakest Republican that the Republican Party could have nominated in the state representative Saccone. Then you have the strongest Democrat that the Democratic Party could have nominated in Brian Lamb, a former Marine Corps officer, former federal prosecutor. He's 33 years old. He's big and strong and good looking. Saccone is 60. He's fat. He's not too, he doesn't have much of an aura about him. But this is a solidly Republican district. Donald Trump won this district by nearly 20 percentage points. It's very white, something like 91% white, and it's poor. It's essentially a coal mining area, with most people having been thrown out of work since the coal mines closed in southwestern Pennsylvania. There are two polls that have come out this week. One shows Saccone winning by 4 points. The other shows Lamb winning by 6 points. What do you think is happening in southwestern Pennsylvania?
The economy, believe it or not. There's a lot of talk right now about how strong the economy is and how the economy is rebounding. What the news media, what the mainstream media never says when it talks about how strong the economy is the fact that the impact on the economic health of American families does not translate to the strength of the economy. So when families in places like the 18th District of Pennsylvania, which used to be, you know, strong middle class coal mining, all American jobs, when they don't have their jobs anymore, when their pensions are dried up and cut, when their benefits for the jobs that exist are cut back, they realize that there's a disconnect between what their Republican Party is telling them as opposed to what they're actually living.
You know, isn't that funny? That district borders West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly the opposite has happened in West Virginia. As the coal mines closed and people moved out of the state in search of work, it became more Republican. More conservative. It actually went against the tide in the rest of the Rust Belt, where people were clamoring for benefits, for example, or high-tech jobs coming in. Let me ask you also about the 18th. Now, the 18th was created specifically to keep a Republican congressman in the House, and that was Congressman Murphy, originally from Pittsburgh. Congressman Murphy was involved in a sex scandal. He got a woman pregnant. He's married, and he got somebody else pregnant and then urged her to have an abortion secretly. So it didn't.
Family values.
Right. And those text messages went public, and he resigned from the House of Representatives. And so there's turmoil in the 18th district. With that said, regardless of who wins this race on Tuesday, tomorrow, that's when the election is, they're going to have to continue campaigning because they're only going to be in office for a few months from tomorrow until the midterm elections. And in those midterm elections, the boundaries of this district and every other district in Pennsylvania are going to change. So tell us about that.
This special election is as much a referendum on the very tenuous message of the GOP and their entire platform in this area, their efforts at gerrymandering, which were obviously clearly partisan. I'm not saying the Democrats wouldn't have done it if they were. They would, probably would have, but it probably wouldn't have been so blatant.
It's the most gerrymandered state in America.
The most gerrymandered state in America. But for the Democrats, this special election is also a referendum on the kind of party the Democrats will be. The cut. So voters are really in this conundrum in this district. And I think all across Philadelphia, they're not just voting for who is going to represent them in the, you know, for the next however many years. They're really voting for what kind of policies they are expecting in their state going forward.
And this is the age old debate inside the Democratic Party. Do they want to be the progressive party, or do they want to be the big tent party with blue dogs from the South and union people from the North and free traders from the West? And the Democrats have just not been able to settle on what kind of party they want to be.
Exactly. The Democrats haven't been able to message their purpose, really. Why should people vote for them? And the Republicans have quite honestly failed on the issues that matter to people, like the people in the 18th district in Pennsylvania: jobs, economic security, education, health care, where you've got an aging population that's relying on Medicare.
Indeed.
And pensions. So the GOP has failed them. They're looking at the Democratic Party and they're not sure what they're going to get with the Democratic Party. So they're voting for a stopgap to wait and see. And that, I think that's a terrible position to put voters in.
I agree. And I think you're right about that. I think this election really is a stopgap just to give the voters of the 18th district, and I think it's going to become like the 4th district or whatever. They're renumbering all of these districts. It's just a stopgap to get us until November, and then figure it out then. I want to come back to the issue of gerrymandering in Pennsylvania, and not just Pennsylvania, but, you know, the Supreme Court has ordered North Carolina to redraw its districts. Wisconsin is in the courts right now. They're going to have to redraw their districts. The Democrats gerrymandered Maryland to push the Republicans out. They're going to have to redraw those districts. But Pennsylvania so far has been the most contentious, and it's because there's a Democratic governor, but the Republicans control the state Senate and the state House. Well, if you look at the district maps, I don't know how the shapes of these districts ever came to be. They look like just blobs of ink. They make no sense to me. They connect parts of the state that really have no political or social or even cultural connection. And the whole point was just to push Democrats out. So the state legislature decided not to change those districts. The Democratic Party sued. They won at the district level. They won at the appeals level. And then they won at the Supreme Court. Why did they win at the Supreme Court? Because Samuel Alito, arguably the most conservative member of the Supreme Court, said, "Come on, you guys. These district boundaries are illegal. They're clearly gerrymandered." He ordered the Republicans to go back and redraw the map. He gave them only 2 weeks to do it. They went back and they ended up with essentially the same map that they started with. And so Alito said again, not good enough. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court drew the boundaries themselves. And so they came up with a map that, you know, if you look at it, you say, okay, well, these districts are as square, as contiguous as they can be. With that said, it also looks like the Democrats could pick up 3 to 5 House seats because of the redrawing of this map. What do you think is going to play out in Pennsylvania? Do you think that the Democrats are really going to be able to capitalize on this?
I think that there will be some wins for the Democrats. And unfortunately, that's what they're banking on. And that's all they're banking on. Because when you have candidates like Greg Edwards in the 7th, which is a really weird looking, it's a really bizarre looking map that was supposed to, one of those gerrymandered districts that was supposed to favor Republicans. Well, it's 88% white. It's the median income is $75,000 just about. And Greg Edwards has picked up the endorsements for from the Service Employees International Union, the Pennsylvania Workers Family Party that helped Larry Krasner win for DA in Philadelphia and other progressive groups. This guy is making inroads in a district that he wasn't even supposed to show up in, even though there's been this huge effort by the GOP to guarantee the a GOP controlled Pennsylvania House, you know, House and Senate in Pennsylvania. Progressive policies are appealing to people. People want what progressives have. It's the Democrat, of course, we expect the Republicans not to want that. Of course, we don't. We know that they don't want progressive policies to take root in it. That's why they gerrymandered the districts.
Right.
But people like Greg Edwards and other progressive candidates throughout the country are being undercut by the Democratic Party because the Democrats aren't looking at how are we going to govern. Once these people vote for us, they're just looking at winning.
It's as though the Democrats learned nothing from the 1994 Republican contract with America.
Absolutely nothing.
You know, and we saw that in this race in Houston, where the Democratic Party, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, actively worked against one of their own candidates. She was the one who ended up winning the primary. But they went so far as to release opposition research on their own candidate.
Yes, they did.
To try to get her to lose.
And for better or for worse, however these races turn out, these midterms and these special elections or whatever turn out for the Democratic Party, one thing is for sure, the populist mood in this country among left-leaning voters and among right-leaning voters is an unstoppable force now. No one can ignore it. The Democrats will continue to ignore it to their peril.
At their own peril. In fact, in that 18th district, Brian Lamb said that if he wins that race, he will not vote for Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House.
He did, absolutely. And O'Rourke. Beto O'Rourke said that he completely repudiated the DNC and the DCCC in his speeches. So we've got candidates who are causing heartache for the Republican Party, a very well-entrenched Republican Party in red states, and causing heartache for the Democrats.
You are absolutely right. We were joined in studio by Jacqueline Lukman, co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can now follow us on Twitter, at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.